From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 39 for Thursday, the 18th of August, 2011. A whole day early, you lucky things. On the show this week, what's the point of pesticides when you could blow up bugs with microwaves instead? Some researchers at MPL are beginning to ask that very question. Plus, how do you win the gold medal for being the world's fastest bipedal robot with knees? It's a question we all must ask ourselves from time to time, but today we've got the answers. All that and more coming up as we wiggle our way through this week's wormhole of Wired News. Hey there, I'm Nate Langson, I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me in the Wired Trinket Cupboard this week, Associate Editor Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
I am back. Did you miss me?
Of course we missed you.
That is the first podcast in 38 episodes I've not been on.
Yeah, well, did it feel weird for you?
It did, but it was great for me, actually, because it meant, you know, you probably still felt my presence in the mix, because I still edited it, but I edited it from a giant orange sofa in my girlfriend's house.
Oh, very nice.
It was powerful.
Yeah, good.
But we have no donuts this week because he has gone to Stockholm. But thank you very much for taking over the show last week. It sounded fantastic. And Duncan, come back soon and bring presents. This week, we're going to talk, to begin with, about Google, which has just bought Motorola for $12.5 billion. That's quite a check to write.
It is.
Motorola, that is half of Motorola, Motorola Mobility, which is the part of the company that does all the mobile technology, so phones and tablets and Android devices. And there's your clue. Google makes Android, of course. The pieces of this puzzle are coming together very, very nicely, aren't they?
It is. I mean, so does this mean that Google's suddenly going to be making a load more phones?
It could be. It's unlikely, though. A lot of people who've commented on this have commented on the sheer number of patents that Google is acquiring as a result of acquiring Motorola Mobility.
Yeah.
And I've seen a number of people comment on the fact that, you know, maybe Google will take on Motorola and will kind of wind down its hardware business and focus solely on the software and the IP that it has and the patents, almost in defense against patent attacks from other competitors in future.
Yeah, well, one of the cool things I read was that Motorola was actually making mobile phones before the Apple computer even existed.
Yeah.
So it's got some of the really fundamental patents throughout, you know, mobile phone development history, which keep it in a really kind of protected, gives Google a really, really protective stance, I guess.
It has, yeah, Motorola has thousands and thousands of really key patents. And the thing is, Motorola actually made some incredibly important Android hardware. So it made the Motorola Zoom, which wasn't the most successful tablet ever released, but it was one of the best. And a lot of people commented on how good it was as a system. And it also did the Droid in the US, which was the Motorola Milestone in the UK. A really important phone. I mean, the Droid in the US kind of got Android off the ground into the mainstream, I think.
Yeah, and this deal increases Google's headcount by a massive amount. I think it's 19,000 new people will come on board as a result of the deal. 60% increase in staff.
It's pretty amazing.
One of the cool things that I saw was on Larry Page's blog, where he was talking about actually kind of focusing on the audiovisual side of what Motorola does, and kind of IPTV and connected TV. And I think that's definitely something to watch out for.
Well, it's another area that Google's in that hasn't actually really taken off. Mm. Google TV has been out in the US for ages now, but it's just failed to get any traction.
Yeah.
People don't seem to want that extra box. They don't see a need for it. But with things like YouTube not necessarily making as much money as it could, Motorola may have quite a lot to offer in that sense. Well, all good news. Let's move on, though, to News International, which hasn't been in the news for about a week, which is probably its longest period over the last few months. Liv, tell me about these letters that have been popping up around the web.
Yeah, well, the Culture, Media and Sport Committee has published a few very kind of incriminating letters distributed between News of the World staff. One of which was from former royal correspondent Clive Goodman, who used to work at the News of the World. And it was a letter that was protesting against his sacking. And in it, he wrote that phone hacking was regularly discussed in editorial meetings, which would mean that people like the major editorial staff and the management would have been well aware of it.
Which they said in their hearings recently that they weren't aware of.
They weren't. And a separate letter from News of the World lawyer Tom Crone suggested that James Murdoch was even aware of the hacking as early as 2008. Again, something that they denied in the hearing.
So what does this mean? Do we go back to more hearings?
It does. There's another hearing on the 6th of September, and so far they're only questioning the last News of the World editor, Colin Meisler, and a lawyer called John Chapman. But it may well be that we have to get the Murdochs back in.
That's going to be a fun day for them.
Yeah.
We need to get some more shaving foam out then, don't we?
Yeah, I know. It was such a waste last time.
It's a story that kind of keeps getting deeper and deeper and more messy, you know, with every passing week, it seems. It's the scandal that won't die. It feels like the MP's expenses thing all over again.
It really does. And I would be very surprised if, you know, there weren't a lot of the other newspapers starting to get dragged through the mud soon as well.
Hmm. Well, other things being dragged through the mud include a bloke. He was in Essex and apparently has been arrested for plotting a water fight on BlackBerry Messenger. And this is the kind of thing that would have never gone anywhere had he not have been caught during the riots that were taking place in London the other week, which, by the way, scary as hell when they're right outside your house.
Yeah,
like it literally in my garden, riot police and people just smashing the hell out of my town.
Yeah, well, you're lucky none of your property, you didn't probably get affected directly, did it?
We didn't get anything broken, no, yeah. I mean, but...
But do you wonder whether the police maybe thought that it was sort of street slang and water actually meant, you know, explosives or something?
It's hard to say, but they were, you know, it's this thing, it's a heightened tension where people are monitoring for anything that they could do. And to be fair, water fights have ended badly in the past. You know, there was the case in a couple of years ago, wasn't there, where it ended
up a girl got punched in the face and 9 people were arrested.
But water fights can turn nasty.
It kind of pales into insignificance in light of recent events.
I do think this is absolutely ridiculous, though, and, you know, whether it goes anywhere after the court appearance in September is another thing, but...
Yeah, but separately, there has been another case with 2 guys, one in Norwich and one in Warrington, who've been arrested and now sentenced for 4 years each for just trying to arrange a kind of violent protest.
Well, you say that. You say just trying to arrange. I mean, this is a time where we're trying to clamp down on people arranging stuff. And, all right, you know, it didn't end up being anything, but was that because it got stopped in time, because
he
got caught?
I guess that's kind of up for debate, but they seem to have got the longest sentences so far of any people who've been sentenced as a result of the riots to date, which seems a little bit extreme, given that they didn't actually create the violence that they planned on creating.
No, but it's part of creating fear and this sort of culture of not terror in the terrorism sense, but you know, just people living in fear. And I think when you think back to what happened with what was the airport where the chap made that joking tweet on Twitter about blowing up the airport, and it was taken seriously to, you know, as being a hateful act. And he was in all kinds of trouble, even though he didn't actually blow up an airport. But it feels like the same sort of kettle of fish to me, that it's a case of shutting things down, keeping things under control, even if it didn't directly lead to riots.
Yeah.
It's the knock-on effect. But
no, that's fair enough.
We'll see how that transpires. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, how would you like to have some exploding insects in your garden?
Registration for the Wire 2011 Summit is now open. Don't miss your chance to hear some of the most inspiring talks from thought leaders of the wired world over 2 days this October in London. For more information, please visit wiredevent.co.uk.
Boom. That's the noise that a bug makes when it goes pop. But actually, it doesn't.
I don't think it makes more like...
That's a good noise.
There.
Feel free to send in your own interpretations, podcast@wired.co.uk. Liv, bug zapping with microwaves, what the actual H?
Yeah, well, I had the privilege of going to the National Physical Laboratory a few weeks ago and then followed up with one of the researchers there called Richard Dudley, who was looking into ways of using microwaves as pesticides. And what this involves is trying to find the exact frequency range that resonates in an insect's body to the extent that it actually might even explode, or at least kind of damage it irrevocably. And so they're trying to find ways to get this frequency right so you could target specific pests such as aphids. So you could put some antennas around your field and only target those. You don't have to spray crops, you know, like from start to finish, killing all insects in your path. But also, you know, when you have aftershocks from explosions, that can sometimes be enough to kind of resonate through a human body and kill them. So in the same way, this is about finding the right frequency based on the size of the insect that will either damage its communication system, it will damage its reproductive system, or it will just completely damage its bodily structure.
And how exactly does this work then? So do you create a kind of a force field around your plant or your field, and if a bug gets in, it just bursts in midair?
Well, there's
that deafening squelch that you did.
Yeah, there are a couple of different. I mean, again, this is such early stages, so let's not forget this isn't something that's happening now. It's very, very early investigations. But you could have aerials that are emitting these waves at a certain frequency around your field, which would either act as a deterrent or as a kind of force field. Or you could go through the crops like you would with a conventional pesticide and send out pulses of a really kind of high energy wave that would kind of explode them on impact.
Why didn't we do this with rioters? Why couldn't we have found out how much a rioter vibrates? Well, and then when they walk through a barrier, they explode.
It's interesting that you say that, because they have used similar-ish technologies to deter young kind of yobs from certain city centres by using a certain sound frequency that is only audible to people under the age of 25. So they had a system called the Mosquito, which apparently NPL worked on, which it was so irritating if you can hear that frequency range, but most people over the age of 25 can't, that it was a deterrent from them loitering around on street corners.
You know, I really think this is the kind of thing that could be implemented in emergencies.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously not to blow people up, but as an actual non-lethal weapon. You know, I mean, they were talking about water cannons, and I read somewhere about filling water cannons with dye so that when the rioters or protesters were causing too much trouble, they could spray them down with this stuff, and they would be dyed
marked
a certain colour so you could see who it was who was at the scene.
Yeah,
you know, which
someone else was suggesting putting people into kind of the modern equivalent of stocks. Like, I think it was Charlie Brooker in a column was suggesting putting them in a transparent box a la, what's he called? Not Darren Brown, David Blaine.
Yeah.
And in the centre of their town and allowing people to kind of throw food at them and just point and stare at them.
Do you not think that's going to annoy them more? I mean, generally, my experience, putting any human being in a box and throwing stuff at them in public view doesn't generally get them on your side.
No, I guess being able to see the kind of damage that you've done from a social perspective, getting people the kind of peer pressure, anger response might be of some value.
Possibly. It sounds like the novel of the topic of a great book,
yeah.
Which is the topic of our next topic, in fact. Wow, that was unplanned.
What, the
segue? The little segue there.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I feel about it.
No, me neither. Podcast at wired.co.uk. The idea of publishing ebooks bit by bit and letting people subscribe to them on their e-readers is something that's kind of been going in Japan for years and years and years, as has many things. But someone's doing this in Europe now.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a Japanese, I guess, I don't know if it's trend or a kind of business model called Kaiti Shusetsu. I don't know if I pronounced that correct, but it was kind of an SMS-based novel system where lots of young people subscribe to these kind of bit part novels. I think they have more space on their SMS in Japan than they do in Europe, I think I'm correct in saying. And so they'd be able to read a chapter at a time of someone's of someone's writing. It could be their whatever it is about their musings, their diary, etc. And there's a new company called Movellus that is doing the same in Europe, and it's been going in Denmark for a few years, and it's been very, very successful, and they're about to launch in the UK.
So this would allow me, so I've got a great idea for a book, maybe blowing up rioters with microwaves or putting them in a box or something like that. And I want to get my book off the ground, but I don't want to sit down and write the whole thing. So I can just write, a chapter or a page at a time, and people can subscribe to it like a newsletter almost.
Yeah, and you can either read it, you can read it, it can be published in an EPUB format, so you can read it directly on your reader, or you can get an SMS alert and then a link, so you can read it on your browser, on your mobile browser. Or you can just read it on your normal browser. But the great thing is it's just really designed from the ground up as a really social platform. So it's all linked to all the different social media channels, and it just makes it a lot stickier than some of the other self-publishing platforms we've seen so far.
But I've seen one major drawback from this service so far, which seems that it's vastly in favour of stories about Justin Bieber.
Yeah.
That instantly makes me want to put it into a box in the middle of a town and blow it up with
microwaves. No, it's not that the model is favours Justin Bieber. It just happens so far that in Denmark, where it's been taking off, a lot of young girls have been writing and a lot of the most popular books have been about Justin Bieber.
So how does this differ from, you know, having one of these old, you know, open diary type blogs where all your friends just subscribe
to it?
It
doesn't. It's just a new way of interacting with the content. And I think it's the way that you can have it in so many different formats. I think it's an easy way of getting access and following in multiple different books.
I'm really in favour of it, by the way. I'm just trying to play devil's advocate a little bit, but it's been massively successful in Japan using the text message model. Mm. And I know you were saying before the show, actually, that something like 5 out of 10 of the top-selling books in a given year, 2007.
I think it was 5 out of 10, but a majority of the books that were sold, the top-selling books in Japan, were originally from SMS novels.
And I think there are it's triple figures now, the number that have been turned into actual books. And I know one of them, and I can't remember the name of it, but one of them was turned into a movie. How mad is that? Yeah. Writing a book on the bus via text message and a few years down the line, it's a film. I mean...
Yeah. It's incredible.
It makes me think that I'm wasting my life by just doing podcasts and...
Well, maybe we'll see you with your Bieber novel coming up soon.
Oh, trust me, I've got the best Bieber story.
Why don't you do a Bieber slasher kind of chapter-based
Have you
novel?
Seen how into Justin Bieber some of these kids are? Yeah. I do not want to suffer the wrath of 1,000 10-year-olds coming to kick my house down again. Because I moaned about Justin Bieber. I don't even know the guy. I'm sure he's perfectly lovely. It just annoys me how every time I'm on any American video show or something, they always say, oh, he's got Bieber hair.
Yeah.
I was born significantly before Justin Bieber, so he actually has Nate Langston hair. Thank you very much. Let's move on from our little digression there and talk about SpaceX. As anyone who has been listening to the show for a while or watching Space News will know, NASA has retired the space shuttles.
Aww.
Very sad. We all cried a little tear and then went back to our lives. And SpaceX, which is actually interestingly part funded by NASA but is a private firm, is going to be sending a resupply spacecraft to the International Space Station in November, which is going to make it the first commercial firm to dock with the ISS since NASA retired the space shuttle program, which is
presumably the first of many, unless we're going to neglect the ISS from...
Well, SpaceX has some big, big plans. And you know, some people have been speculating that SpaceX could be the company to get a man to Mars.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if there's not enough money being funded into NASA for them to do it, then why not NASA let them fund the private people and
Absolutely.
Let them get there?
It's awesome to see a private enterprise getting involved in things like this, which have never really been done on a private level. It'd be great to see, you know, how much quickly you can move if you're not hindered by government, you know, regulations.
But of course, this all ties into the, you know, the growing feasibility of private space travel and people taking themselves to, you know, lunar orbiting space stations, which, by the way, great place to dump writers.
Oh, yeah.
In near-Earth orbit.
Possibly.
Yeah. NASA has told SpaceX that it can launch this unmanned Falcon 9 rocket on the 30th of November 2011. 9 days later, the cargo craft will have deployed, reached the space station and started berthing with the orbiting laboratory up there. So pretty interesting mission to be going on just before Christmas. Quite
berthing
nice.
And berthing sound very similar, don't they?
Yeah, they do, actually, even though they're radically different things.
But, yeah, it's just interesting, isn't it? I'm picturing now it giving birth to its cargo as opposed to kind of docking on the ISS.
I've still got the mental image that you gave me last week of a woman injecting herself with horse blood and then parading around a stage in fake hooves, stroking a horse and talking about how they had an emotional connection with, you know, each other.
Yeah.
Freakiest thing I've ever accidentally dreamt about.
Okay,
thanks for that. It was very good. If anyone didn't hear that show, go and check out last week's show. Craziest thing ever involving horses. Someone else who's been a bit crazy, Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, he has come up with 3 patents, 3 rather interesting ideas about how to protect dropped smartphones. And these include airbags, springs, and lunar lander-style thrusters.
It's just go-go gadget all over again, isn't it?
Yeah, some of these designs involve a phone that would use a gyroscope, which is a thing that, if you use an iPod or an iPhone, helps the device know which way it's being held up if you're like, steering with your iPod. A gyroscope, a camera, a radar, sonar, laser, or an infrared beam to detect how fast the phone is moving and its orientation and its distance from, say, the floor, so they could deploy, like, basically an airbag.
I think this is just awesome. I mean, all I can imagine is this being deployed at all sorts of inappropriate times and being stuffed back into some micro container somewhere on the electronic device. I mean, it's pretty ridiculous, right?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. But it's one of these patents where, you know, he has an idea, they patent it. It wasn't, I think it was a patent from last year, actually. Beginning of last year, yeah. February 2010, that's just been discovered online. And it's one of these ideas that just needs protecting so they can claim we did it first.
Can do it.
Amazon is, you know, very seriously now getting into the mobile industry hardware-wise because of the Kindle. And we strongly believe that there's going to be a Amazon tablet, possibly even this year, to compete with the iPad as a color ebook reader. And it's interesting to see the ways that they're thinking of protecting those devices, you know.
This really reminds me of, there was a cycle helmet that you wore as a kind of collar that came out, I think it was earlier this year, maybe the end of last year. And instead of wearing an actual helmet, you had this little collar thing that as, if you reached a certain acceleration as you were cycling and you kind of bumped into something or you fell at a certain rate, it would deploy and it would inflate to be this kind of enormous, looked like a kind of motorcycle helmet style thing around your chin and around your head, so that it protects you, but you could still look cool.
Mind blown.
Yeah,
in a nice inflated case, but still mind blown.
There's an amazing
video. That's
crazy. Yeah, I mean, I guess you'd probably, I don't know how much you'd trust it to deploy, but they did loads of tests and it's on our YouTube video and it's really awesome to look at.
Could you imagine walking into a pub and seeing someone fall in and saying, please help me get my helmet off, my head bag is inflated and my head is stuck and I have no blood in my eyes.
I don't think it was quite that tight. But
it would be if I were.
You never know.
Definitely. That's awesome though. I like stuff like that. You know, there's some amazing things that have been patented and never fully implemented. But did you know there's a patent for toast?
What?
Yep. Guess when it was patented?
I don't know.
About 10 years ago.
For what? What do you mean, patent for toast?
There is a patent, and it's something like the refreshing of bread using a heated implement or something like that. And it's toast.
What? So if I cook my toast on the grill, am I...
It's more that if you sold a product that created toast, then I think maybe on some level you are violating a patent on toasting bread.
Oh, extraordinary.
There was a really great podcast a few weeks ago that came out from the This American Life podcast, which people should check out if they want to, about called When Patents Attack.
Yeah.
Brilliant explanation of how sort of patent law at the moment is being abused and how ridiculous it is that we have these things like patent trolls, but not obviously that's not what I'm suggesting old Amazon is doing, but it's an interesting and controversial area of business, particularly at the moment. Anyway, don't know why we got off on that tangent, but let's move on to actually our last story of the news this week, which is there's a robot with knees that's managed to achieve quite a speed.
Yeah, Mabel, the robot, has managed to run. And bear in mind, this is Mabel with two legs and knees, which is amazingly pointed out, can run at 6.8 miles per hour.
So this robot apparently went through 3 years of training, which included poor little broken robot limbs, and has got the gold medal for, quote, the world's fastest bipedal robot with knees.
Well, I mean, it says gold medal. It's basically won. It's the world's fastest robot in terms of records. It hasn't got any...
A figurative gold medal.
A figurative gold medal.
Not a literal one. But still, pretty amazing, right? Because this is, although not necessarily something we're going to see on the streets, it's lots of areas of research, and this they think could be applied to exoskeletons, but lots and lots of little areas of development in making bipedal robots for future application in things like war zones, or for, you know, running into a burning building dragging somebody out, or there's a lot of talk about how these sort of walking machines, like do you remember the big dog?
Yes.
That had like six legs.
Awesome.
Craziest thing I've ever seen.
You could
Freaky.
Kick it and it would like readdress its balance in this amazing way.
Yeah, Google big dog robot on YouTube and you'll find the freakiest video you'll ever see about a robot. But these things where they can tackle terrain that hasn't been cleared for a vehicle to go over, and so it's really, really useful for maybe even carrying injured humans or carrying massive payloads over terrain that just physically can't be traversed with wheels.
Yeah.
So pretty cool that this robot has managed to achieve a new record.
And just to add, it's made by the University of Michigan is where Mabel's been made.
Good old
Mabel.
So
well done them.
Good old Mabel. That's the end of our news section for this week, and it's actually the end of our show because we don't have a feature. It's been a very weird week. Lots of people away. Everyone's on holiday in August.
Yeah, I'm not on holiday.
But our feedback machine is always open to your comments. Liv, tell people how they can get in touch.
Well, you can first of all follow us on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK. Nate is on @NateLankson. Duncan is @DuncanGibb, but he's not here, so don't email him. I am @Olivia_Solon.
And we're on Facebook at... what are we on?
Facebook.com/WiredUK.
You'd have thought the amount of times we've said this now, I'd have actually remembered. It's just so tired. It's like 5:15.
Yeah, you can go and like us on that, or you can email us on podcast@wired.co.uk.
Absolutely, you should. And we'll see you again next week.
Bye. I'm happy to be wriggling through a wormhole of news.
I just love to wriggle.
Okay, good.
Yep.